Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast marking the end of an era. My name's Corey Hastless, and I'm afraid Steve is still ill, bathing in Lemsip in a Not Enough Champagne bunker. So we are delighted to be joined for the second time by Charlotte Galpin, lecturer in German and European politics at the University of Birmingham. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Corey.
So this episode, if all goes to plan, should be coming out the week before we learn about the outcome of the Tory leadership race. So the Sunday you're listening to this, listeners, could be Theresa May's last Sunday as Prime Minister, assuming we're not in an absolutely catastrophic constitutional crisis. We're going to be looking back on her reign as Prime Minister, and we're going to start by looking at the phenomenon Wikipedia calls the glass cliff. So, Charlie, what's the glass cliff?
So, basically, this is a concept created by, I think, some management studies scholars, where they basically did a study of CEOs to investigate. So, there was some data that showed a correlation between companies that had female CEOs and that company failing. So, these academics decided they wanted to investigate that a little bit more closely and to kind of think about whether it's just, you know, being a woman that means that your company fails, or whether there's something else going on. And what they found was basically that women were more likely to end up in those leadership positions precisely at the moment when the company starts to do badly. So it's this idea that women are kind of thrust into leadership positions when the chances of success are quite low.
There's also been some academic evidence or studies that have been done showing that law students, say, for instance, are more likely to assign high-risk cases to a female counsel rather than a male counsel. And there's also been some studies with undergraduates on the politics side. So also undergraduates are more likely to select a male candidate for a safe by-election result than a female candidate. So this is a bit of an obvious question, but how does the glass cliff then apply to Theresa May?
So I think there are many examples of this in politics as well. So obviously, Theresa May became Prime Minister at a moment when Britain was facing its basically biggest crisis since, I don't know.
We can't say the Second World War because the whole point is certainly Suez.
Suez. So she became Prime Minister in the summer of 2016, right after the EU referendum, when basically all the men stepped back. Cameron resigns, Farage resigns from as UKIP leader, Boris Johnson and Michael Gove kind of destroyed each other as in that kind of leadership contest. And that's when Theresa May kind of became Prime Minister.
Because I suppose also other male candidates don't run. So people like Jeremy Hunt ran this time, didn't then. You can sort of understand why people like Matt Hancock and Sajid Javid didn't run because they didn't quite have the profile. But George Osborne could have run as a sort of continuity Cameroon. Yeah. That's an interesting
one. And he decided to leave politics altogether. Right? So, yeah. And this is something that I think we can see parallels of in other contexts. So Angela Merkel became leader of CDU at a time when the CDU was embroiled in a scandal. Andrea Nahles last year, in 2017, became leader of the SPD in Germany after the SPD had its worst result ever, basically, in the national election. So there are lots of kind of examples of kind of men stepping back and not wanting to take on these kind of roles when it's quite likely that they will do badly.
I was trying to think of a British example, but I can't, because in the Labour Party, obviously, there's no female leaders and obviously just no sense of impending crisis, which is nice. I think with May, that explains a lot of it, I think. Although it doesn't then, I don't think, quite explain why the Tories are getting rid of her now, or rather, she had to resign essentially because there were she'd lost her party, lost her cabinet. And I suppose a lot of that is almost because of the other quality, that the lack of quality she has to make a decent prime minister, I suppose. Or rather, what seems to have happened is partly it's because she entered cross-party talks with the Labour Party, which pissed off a lot of Tory MPs. She was seen as not being approachable in her dealings with colleagues, which we could maybe argue is partly because of male Tory MPs and her gender, possibly. But the reason why she's in a bit of the pickle that she is, essentially, is because she used Brexit after becoming Prime Minister, and she was in a phenomenally strong position. You know, when she started, her approval ratings were amazingly high, but then used Brexit as a vehicle to try and enrich the Tory party, and essentially made the calculation that Tory votes plus UKIP votes equals majority. And so tries to pursue this very extreme version of Brexit, saying that we must be out of the single market, out of the customs union. Aided and abetted, of course, I suppose, by Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill. That's a fly you can hear, listeners, if you can hear that on the podcast, that vague buzzing. It's just the bunker worry that Boris Johnson is going to become Prime Minister. But so aided and abetted, yeah, by Nick Timothy, Fiona Hill. So you have three people, all unelected, in the Cabinet Office, decide on this really extreme version of Brexit, which isn't what anything anyone voted for. And May continually as well, talking about how no deal's better than a bad deal, has begun the normalisation of no deal that we see now, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think she made a lot of mistakes early on. And as you say, she set these red lines, which basically made Brexit, that basically has taken us to where we are today. We could have left the EU already if she hadn't have set those red lines. So leaving the customs union, having no ECJ control, leaving the single market, and all of these pose those very serious problems for Northern Ireland, and also kind of alienated any of the kind of soft Brexiteers or also kind of soft Remainers who might have signed up to a kind of Norway-style deal. But at the same time, I think we also have to think about the fact that Brexit itself, what was promised during the referendum, was never really achievable. So I think one reason why many of the male politicians at that time didn't want to take on this job is because it was an impossible job, in that all kinds of incompatible, contradictory promises were made that no one could ever fulfil. We can't keep all the benefits of the single market and end freedom of movement. We can't respect a Good Friday Agreement and make sure we keep control of all of our trade deals. Like, all of these things were promised but are incompatible.
And then May tries to do that with a backstop, which is, of course, ironically, a concession from the EU to our negotiating position, which is then the thing that's used time and again as a reason why Tory MPs won't vote for the deal.
Yeah.
I suppose what the May deal does then is try and square that circle of Brexit, which I suppose is difficult because I think the last British male to take on an impossible job was Graham Taylor, and football fans will know how that worked out. There's a reality in which May sidelines the ERG, knocks on Labour's door, maybe even Lib Dems at that point, and the SNP, and says, right, we're going to do Norway, we're going to do a proper soft Brexit, will you pass it with me? And probably, if she'd done that, that probably would have gone through, assuming, of course, then it depends on what the ERG would have done through, but I can see there's a scenario where she reaches out to opposition MPs a lot earlier, and we could have left by now with a soft Brexit. I'm not sure that is possible now, for lots of different reasons we've already talked about. But I suppose the other thing is that because May is such a creature of the Tory party, you know, that when she sacks George Osborne after she becomes Prime Minister, she says, you know, you need to go to the back benches and learn more about the party. There's this sense that May is a creature of the Tory party. You know, she met her husband through the Oxford University Conservatives. She's been giving out leaflets since she was a teenager. There's always a sense that she is very tribally conservative. And not only that then, but also as Home Secretary, very concerned about immigration. And so interprets the Brexit result as being one about immigration.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is ironic given that actually attitudes to immigration have softened since the referendum result, but May, I think one of the reasons why May went with such an undeliverable Brexit position is partly because, as you say, the promises in the referendum weren't possible, but also because May's thing has always been about trying to keep immigration down, and the only way to do that was to leave the single market.
Yeah, and I mean, we talk about her as a Remainer, but I think probably quite a reluctant one in that, as you mentioned with her Home Office record, that she is very anti-immigration. She's also rallied against the European Court of Human Rights, which is obviously not the EU, but still a part of that whole discourse. So I think, you know, she's quite far on the right of the Conservative Party and probably has many sympathies with UKIP and UKIP.
The impression I got was that she came out in favour essentially for her leadership ambitions, or maybe just to keep in with Cameron and Osborne, which probably it seemed like the winning horse at the time. And I mean, people like Sajid Javid seemed to be quite similar, I think, who I think was also a Remainer. Yeah.
But she was a very quiet Remainer. You know, she didn't really get particularly involved in the campaign. And I think that was her strategy, not to really associate herself too much with either side, so that she could appeal to both kind of camps when it came to it.
I think it's been a while since I read All Out War, the Tim Shipman book on this, but from what I remember, I think she did one campaign intervention which was just so abominably bad the Stronger In campaign just kept her away from all. Although when I was on the People's Vote March, the last really big one, I think that they reckon had the million people there, I saw a banner and I wish I'd taken a picture of it, but it was the picture of Theresa May with the Stronger In, with an arrow pointing to it saying, "I'm the person Theresa May is with in that picture." And I think it was someone from the local Tory party who was out campaigning for Remain with May. And I wish I'd taken a picture, but you know, regrets, I've had a few and all that. And the impression I get about May as a Prime Minister, I suppose, is someone who, in terms of the context of the British Prime Ministers, it feels like Prime Ministers like Edward Heath and Harold Wilson, those who wanted to be big, bold and transformational. So Wilson has big plans to forge a new Britain in the white heat of technology, which gets knocked out in the 60s with the devaluation of the pound, I think, in particular in 66. And Edward Heath has these proto-Thatcher ideas about free markets and what have you, but they get lost in fights and unions and the three-day week and the strikes in the early 70s. And when May becomes Prime Minister and stands on the steps of Downing Street and talks about wanting to think about those who've been left behind and forgotten about, it was I think I wrote at the time for the Not Enough Champagne website, it was the kind of speech you could imagine Ed Miliband doing, just without the bits on Brexit. There was this sense that she wanted to be bold and transformational. And you can see in her legacy now that she's been trying to find things on Grenfell or domestic violence or the environment, anything to try and give herself a legacy apart from Brexit.
Yeah.
But she doesn't have it because there was this, all these events which knocked her off course.
Yeah, I think it's been very interesting to see the kind of what she's been doing over the last few weeks now that she's in her final throes of her premiership, that she's trying to kind of come back to these issues that she never really had the chance to do. But I think if we come back to the glass cliff, you know, that shows very well why perhaps many others did not want to take on that job in 2016, because the only legacy for a prime minister that took that on would have been Brexit, and she will always be defined by that.
Yeah, and I suppose going back to the issue of sexism, toxic masculinity, all that kind of stuff, there's been a lot of violent language used about Theresa May. Again, going back to George Osborne again, was apparently quoted saying that he wanted to see her chopped up in bits in his freezer when there were talk of a leadership coup. I can't remember if it was earlier this year or last year, there was talk of the fatal blow and being repeatedly stabbed and, you know, the knives being sharpened, this kind of stuff. And also, just in terms of the fact that three times more comments are made about Theresa May and her appearance than Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, certainly when Corbyn was first Labour leader, there was a lot of comments on his appearance, so to have three times more is kind of interesting. There's been a whole... It's not really been a great advert, I suppose, of how to talk about a female prime minister.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that very much characterises the whole debate about Brexit that we've seen over the last few years. And I think it's not even just Theresa May, it's also any female MP who talks about Brexit, and especially those that oppose Brexit. So people like Jess Phillips, people like Anna Soubry, Sarah Wollaston, all of these kind of Remainer MPs, they are subject to just constant death and rape threats and violence, language, and particularly online, but also in, you know, also coming from prominent politicians. So I think there's this kind of very negative culture, a negative climate for women in politics. And then not even just this kind of violent language, but also I think we've seen Theresa May be the focus of, as you say, like the toxic masculinity that I think is really a part of Brexit and in and the Conservative Party in particular, which I think is related to a kind of attempt to exercise power over her to push their version of Brexit. So we have people like Marc Francois, who's constantly kind of using very militaristic language. So there's one quote where he says, when asked why he wasn't going to vote for May's deal because he was in the army, because it would be a lose, and he was in the army and he wasn't trained to lose. Then the people like Steve Baker described himself as the hard man of Brexit. So we have a situation where we have a female prime minister faced with this kind of excessive displays of masculinity in trying to in opposing her.
I think what will be really interesting or terrifying in about 6 months is to see where a new prime minister goes with the deal, because there's a, as I kind of, hinted, there's a bit of a sense that somehow no deal that Theresa May put through would be accepted by Tory MPs, and a lot of it seems to be because it was her that was doing it. And when you talk to MPs about Theresa May, there was a real dislike about her style of governing, which I, about essentially just not being able to ask the straight questions or just not being very, very sociable with them. But I think what will be interesting is if we're in a situation in a few months' time with probably Boris Johnson, maybe Jeremy Hunt, who knows what's happened in the last 2 weeks since we're recording this. But if Boris Johnson ends up putting lipstick on some sort of withdrawal agreement, now he's not going to be able to renegotiate it. But if he gets a codicil on the backstop similar to May got, I think, over meaningful vote, two, I forget now, there's been so many of them. But if I can see, I don't know if it's likely, but I think there's a situation where Tory MPs who wouldn't vote for May's deal because it's May's deal will quite happily vote for Boris Johnson's deal because it's Boris, quote unquote. Yeah. Because he went to the right school and he's more affable and clubbable, and is somehow, because he's because he was involved with the Leave campaign, is somehow able to square the impossible circle of Brexit.
Yeah, yeah, I absolutely think that we might see that situation where Boris is simply able to kind of bluster his way through re-presenting this deal, essentially, because we know that he's not going to get any significant changes to it. But yeah, as you say, he's kind of one of them, and he's he behaves in a way that they like and respect.
Yeah, I've been trying to have this thought for a bit and not quite sure how to vocalise it, which is obviously a bit of a problem with the podcast. But I wonder if part of the problem for Theresa May is almost the way in which British media, but Tory MPs in particular, maybe view how a female prime minister should act. So Tory MPs would probably see a female prime minister acting essentially in the Margaret Thatcher model, and I suppose Thatcher is someone who's very aware of her gender and the fact she was a woman and had a particular style of governing, which I suppose especially that they tend to be a bit more hectoring, tend to be a bit more bullying, I suppose one could say, very forceful, very direct. Whereas May, I suppose, is more dogged, more determined, a bit more difficult, in a very kind of Jeff Boycottian way, I suppose, but very kind of limpet-like. So when then May does probably the, one of the greatest mistakes of her premiership to call that, well, maybe the mistake isn't necessarily to call the election, but it's to campaign in the way that she did, and I think, as we've said, like the on previous podcast, the problem with that election campaign is they try and build a personality cult around someone who doesn't have a personality, which is maybe a bit harsh, but they try. There was a Daily Mail headline, I think, which is "Steal of the New Iron Lady," and this whole idea of May crushing the saboteurs. And May really isn't that kind of politician. It's very much a quiet, insular, talks to a few advisors, comes to a view, sticks to it, and just carries on that kind of view, which isn't what that's not Thatcher. And again, there's different ways of doing politics, but I think that trying to put someone who's obviously uncomfortable with the idea of talking about herself in public and having her front this election campaign, which is about her and her personality, but also it's about her personality, which it wasn't May's personality they were trying to sell. They were essentially trying to make her out to be Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's something in this idea that kind of Thatcher was the kind of only acceptable woman to have as prime minister, and that any other kind of way, any other kind of form of femininity would be, yeah, not really accepted by the Conservative Party or by the public. And I think the way that we talk about May has become very, you know, is very gendered. I think this idea that she's not approachable or she's not sociable, this is, you know, I would wonder whether we would ever describe a man in those terms, because there's always been a kind of idea that women have to be kind of people pleasers, they have to be kind of caring and looking out for others, and if then a woman is seen as kind of keeping herself to herself and isolating herself, then that's going to open her up to those kind of criticisms.
No, I suppose a lot of it comes from the fact that she was apparently with or didn't do dinners with journalists, or if she did, then wouldn't say very much. Yeah. And I suppose it's maybe this almost that I'm sure a lot of MPs don't give dinners with journalists, but the ones who do are the ones who the journalists will probably write more favourably about. And so you have this kind of vicious cycle, I suppose, as well.
But this, I mean, this says something about our political culture, and that ultimately our political culture and the culture in Westminster in particular is a masculine political culture. It's only, you know, it's only relatively recently in its history that women have been allowed into that space. But it was built by men, and it was built in a time where women did not have access to these spaces. And so all of this stuff about, you know, deals being made in Westminster bars, kind of that kind of schmoozing with journalists, this kind of thing is not really open to, or it kind of it excludes female politicians from that process. So I think what that kind of particular criticism of May shows is how masculine our culture is.
Having watched the first episode of the BBC documentary on Margaret Thatcher, which is interesting and worth a watch, Shirley Williams talks about, I think, the space for women in the House of Commons that had just been set up. I mean, we're talking probably mid-70s. And of course, it's the only space in the House of Commons that has an ironing board. You know? I don't imagine that the places where Enoch Powell and Tony Benn were hanging about had ironing boards somehow.
I mean, there were never female toilets in the House of Commons, right? These kind of things. It's only recently that the House of Commons has a creche, that Parliament sat until late into the night, which is very difficult if you have children or you don't have someone at home looking after your children. And so there are all kinds of ways in which the whole culture is designed around men.
I think if you read the accounts of the coalition government, it does feel like, you know, May was never part of the Cameron Osborne sofa government clique. Almost she was there as a bit of an outsider, really. Yeah. And I suppose in the Tory Party, she's a bit of an outsider. Yeah. You know, it's not that she's come from a humble background, but not necessarily the poshest of the posh.
No, definitely not. And she probably hasn't had that socialisation that Cameron and people like Cameron and Osborne that have had, this kind of Eton boy background, like this, also Boris Johnson's kind of style. And if she is a quieter person, if she is that kind of reserved person that we kind of think that she is, then she's never going to feel comfortable in those kind of situations, which should be okay, but because of the way our kind of culture works.
I remember talking, we did a podcast a couple of years ago, Steve and I, probably 3 years ago actually, when May became Prime Minister, on, you know, what makes a good Prime Minister, and the question I posed to Steve then was, would someone like Clement Attlee become Prime Minister now? Because Attlee was famously terse, not giving the best of answers in the media. And I'm not comparing Theresa May to Clement Attlee. I think there's a, you know, you can critique the culture whilst accepting she was a hopeless prime minister. But I wonder if, you know, Theresa May is a part of the reason is, I suppose, like one of the things that David Cameron's really effective at prime minister was emoting publicly, whether it was, you know, the Bloody Sunday inquiry and his response to that, that kind of thing, that isn't part of May's repertoire. And again, yeah, as you say, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because there are things that a prime minister has to do that are more important than putting on a grim face at important events. And maybe one of them is the decisions you make as well. And again, probably depends who we have as prime minister, but one of the things that you can maybe give May credit for when she was prime minister is the fact that when she was staring into the abyss of do we leave without a deal or not, May was very clear that we don't leave without a deal.
Yeah.
Which, judging by the Tory leadership contest, a lot of leadership candidates would make the wrong choice in that. So, yeah, it's interesting how that maybe someone with May's personality just can't be prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, now, I think it, yeah, it says what kind of thing do we expect from prime ministers? What does a prime minister look like? How does a prime minister behave? How well do you engage with that kind of media circus?
Just to finish off, I had a vague thought of somehow if we were in an alternative universe in which Theresa May wasn't prime minister and she was still Home Secretary, what would probably have happened was the Windrush scandal would have brought her down, because that was probably about end of 2017, wasn't it? Start of 2018. Yeah. And I imagine the new prime minister would probably have kept May as Home Secretary. So rather than Amber Rudd taking the blame, it would probably have been May. And then it's probably still a journey that ends in failure. But I almost wonder if what we talk about more in terms of May's legacy was the Windrush stuff rather than the Brexit stuff.
That could quite well be. I mean, I think will not go away, that and it's being kind of continually referred to also in relation to EU citizens and how it will be very interesting, I think, to look back and in 10 years or so and see how do we actually look back on May's legacy and what of those years as Home Secretary do we think about, and I think we can also attribute a lot of responsibility to her for the general climate of hostility towards immigrants that led to the vote itself taking place.
I kind of wish, I almost wish we could just fast forward 10 years. I'm not really sure I want to live through this.
Don't want to do it.
Yeah, can we go straight to the history?
I'll join you if I
want. Thanks. Hopefully, Steve will be back next week and we'll be talking about a new prime minister. I get scared just thinking about it.
I'm very scared about it.
In the meantime, we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Deppert is responsible for our theme tune, Bookie Good Times. Charlie's not on Twitter.
No, so you can type my name into Google if you want.
And I'm on Twitter at Acoustic Radical. That's Steve's handle.
you can find Steve on Twitter.
You can find Steve on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter @PaperbackWriter. Happy plotting, everyone.